so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Michael Rossman, who has really been a key liaison, in a way, an X-ray crystallographer pushing the EM community for better resolution, better maps, so they can fit their structures into our maps. And right now we have a symbiotic relationship, I think. So I'll turn it over to Michael.
Wow. I'm not sure whether it's symbiotic or parasitic. I'm very, very pleased to be here, and it's really the 24 hours or whatever I will have been here has been really worthwhile. It's amazing to see this sort of development of the electron microscopy field. I remember when Tim Baker first came to Purdue. Oh yeah, Mike. Where's the mic? So, do I have to?
Pulling down on that dog's back. It's been a long week. We went to record you, actually. Can you put it very close to your collar? I will put it on for you if you want. Here we go. Sorry, can you start again? Because we really want to record the whole thing.
Once more, with feeling.
Well, I was just commenting on the fact that it's really great to be here and to see the sort of change which is happening in the world of structural biology, which I think is now absolutely dependent on having both electron microscopy and crystallography, as well as probably other things like NMR. But this relationship is great. And I was about to say, before I was told to put the microphone on, that... when Tim Baker first came to Purdue, he had actually taught me a little bit. I was on a sort of similar school in Cambridge where he was a teacher and I was a student. Then this was a good experience. So we decided Purdue, this is good, and that's how we employed Tim. But at that time, well, frankly, electron microscopy was just what I call globology. And it wasn't, you know, it was interesting, but... now it's more than interesting. It's really useful. And so by combining the EM with X-ray crystallography, I think it's really we're getting to border where you know, sort of cell biology becomes understandable. And I'll just be talking about fitting things into electron microscopy. And this is the... kind of program what I want to go through, and I'll be reminding you of how we're getting along as we go along. The first thing when you're dealing with electron microscopy, you've got to remember that electron microscopists really don't know what size they're talking about, and you have to scale the electron microscopy map to some sort of absolute scale, because electron microscopists tell you they know, but it's only approximate, maybe plus or minus 5%. And if you're going to fit a structure where you know the accuracy of bonds and bond lengths and so on, with great, you know, down to maybe 1/100th of an angstrom, you've got to put your electron microscope map onto hopefully an accurate scale. So the first thing you've got to try to do, if you can, put your map onto a scale. We can do that, if we're lucky, by having some kind of X-ray map, because X-ray maps, you generally know what the pretty accurately what the scale is of the map, because we know fairly accurately the wavelengths that you're using. Used to be you knew it very well in the days we did things in the lab where we had a characteristic X-radiation, you know that very accurately. But when we go to synchrotrons, we're moving all over the scale there, and sometimes we don't really know what the wavelength is in a synchrotron. The next thing I want to talk about is symmetry. That has a considerable impact in your fitting process. It can help a lot. I want to talk about criteria of fitting, how atoms fit into density, and avoiding negative density, steric hindrance, and restraints which you can impose. These restraints, as I shall be showing you, are related to other chemical or other types of information which you can put into the fitting process, additional to just having the EM map. And then you've got these different criteria, you've got to combine them. Each of these different criteria may have a different sort of dimension, lengths or counts of atoms and so on. So you want to put them onto some uniform scale or comparable scale, dimensionless scale actually, and combine them to get an overall criteria of fit. You have to think about how to search for the best fit. And this can be rotational, it can be many-dimensional. And finally, it's important to be able to validate what you've done. Is it right? How likely is it that you're right? And I know that in a lot of the earlier work which we've done, my crystallographic friends always say, well, you're not really quite sure whether it's right. Just a bit of glob of density. Is it this way up or that way up? You really don't know. Well, I think you can know. And the validation process will tell you how actually very good things can be done. And then what other problems there are, symmetry mismatches and unknown structural components, are there any? I heard a new name here at this meeting. Steve Lutke was mentioning it this morning. Also heard other people mention it. Something like segmentation or finding, is that the right word? To me that just means finding the envelope of a given protein. So now I've got a new word, so I go away with some more vocabulary. Alright, so let's get started then on the first topic here, that's scaling maps. Now when you compare maps, you have to remember that they could have what crystallographers call different temperature factors. What emphasis do you put on the higher or lower resolution terms? So you should really, when you compare maps, invert them, Fourier invert them, and make sure that they, if you scale the amplitudes of the different Fourier terms, that they fall off with resolution at the same level. Unless you do that, you're going to be in trouble. But when you have done that, you still have what I call the horizontal scale. I've got an EM map, I've got an XA map. I can believe the XA map, the scale, I can believe the intervals between the grid points or pixels in the EM terms. What's the distance between them? And then I can adjust it on the EM map, and that's down here. What should the pixel be? And I try various pixel sizes. And this gives me either the correlation coefficient, that's 1 going down to 0.6 here, or a crystallographic R factor type of thing. I'll be defining those. And you can see the R factor has to come to a maximum where the scale is right, and correlation has to come to a maximum, and the R factor has to come to a minimum. And fortunately, about the same place that happens, so about the correct size for the EM map in this case would be 3.4 angstrom. But before, I forget what this was. I think this was scaling a poliovirus map had a receptor stuck to it to an X-ray map of polio. So how does this scaling work in some more detail? Oops, wrong way. I'll be going over this very slowly, all the sort of mathematical part. I'll just give you some idea. So there are two ways of doing this. You just saw we can define an R factor, this you minimize the difference then between, say, row 1 would be the X-ray map. Here, row 1 is the reference map, the X-ray map. And row 2 is the EM map, and you can scale it with the two scale factors, a constant, just some number which you add to every pixel to put them on about the same average value, and b, some multiplier. And that's assuming that both maps have the same temperature factor fall-off. But so you have to imagine these two maps. They're sampled initially both at the same intervals, say both at, shall we say, 3 angstrom intervals. No, it would be here 1 angstrom intervals. But you want to expand or shrink the EM map. So when you expand it, you know the places where you sample it will be at non-integral grid points in the EM map. So you have to do some interpolation, and that you can do. When you eventually got it right, which you saw on the previous slide, then you can also ask what you should have asked, I guess, before, is will every part of the map give me the same kind of answer? Now, this was a virus. I'll be talking a lot about virus because this is what we work on. And a virus, in this case, was a spherical or icosahedral virus. We can take different shells for doing the R factor calculation or the correlation coefficient calculation. Here are different, these are shells in 108 to 120 angstrom shell and so on, different shells. And we can look at the R factor or correlation coefficient. I just got the correlation coefficient here. And you can see the correlation coefficient actually goes up and it becomes a maximum at this radius. And that's because the virus is a shell of protein. Inside the shell, there's nucleic acid, which doesn't really have any structure, it's very uniform. But on the outside here, you really get structure, and that's where you get the best correlation. And so if you want to really be careful, you should only optimize either the R factor or correlation coefficient using the density in this area. And that usually we find gives us a pretty good scale factor, this kind of procedure. So now, having got that, we can go ahead with other things. And here, as I go over this table again, now I want to get onto symmetry. And I'm going to discuss this in terms of our work on an alpha virus called Synvis virus. Synvis virus has T equals 4 symmetry. Now, may I just get a show of hands here? Could those who do not know and be very honest what I mean by T number for triangulation number, those who do not know? About half. Yeah, that makes it real difficult. All right. This has T equals 4 symmetry. T equals, so let's first of all, the asymmetric unit of an icosahedron is shown here. An icosahedron has 60 asymmetric units, and these are related by a fivefold axis, threefold axis, twofold axis, threefold axis. Now, it's a sphere, but so I'm showing here just one asymmetric unit. And T equals 4 means that there are 4 essentially, roughly speaking, quasi-equivalent units in here. The unit in here is one E-glycoprotein. Now, Synvis virus is more complicated than I'm telling you, but on the outside, there are 2 glycoproteins, E1 and E2. And I'm talking here about the E1 glycoprotein. The structure of the E1 glycoprotein was determined by Felix Rey. For Semliki forest virus, which is a very similar virus. And so we could fit that into the cryo-EM density. And there'll be going to be 4 of these. If you look at this triangle, say, take this blue one called 11. Well, that's the same. This is repeated by fivefold symmetry, a green one, another blue one, another blue one, another blue one, and so on. That's object in this triangle. The green one here is clearly different to that one, and this blue one is different, and then there is this brown one. So the four types of proteins which are in the asymmetric unit are brown or orange, whatever this is, green, and blue, and really 4 and 5 are in fact two types of green ones, in fact, should have different colors for that. So now, how do you generate this? This triangle represents an icosahedral threefold axis. And because I used to be a crystallographer, still am, I suppose, I call it a crystallographic symmetry. It's perfect all over the virus. And so I start with this, start putting in this particular molecule into density corresponding to this. I'll be showing you this. I can then generate number 2 and 3 by means of the icosahedral symmetry. And I know where the icosahedral symmetry is because the cryo-EM map was constructed using icosahedral symmetry. So I know exactly where that is. But now I use a non-crystallographic symmetry. Sorry about these crystallographic terms. That means it's not perfect. It's only locally true. So for molecule one, I can assume there's a twofold here, a quasi-twofold axis about here, which generates this molecule. And then by means of this quasi-threefold axis, I can generate number five and six. And then with the fivefold symmetry, by this time we've got four molecules, one, two, three, and four. But this six is put in there. That's the same as that by virtue of the crystallographic or icosahedral fivefold symmetry. So this is a way that I can generate the different T equals four different molecules in asymmetric unit. When I want fit, I want to fit this into this density, I want to fit this into this density, and that into that density, and this into that density. But they're all related by symmetry. So if I fit this here, and I have the symmetry elements, the others will follow automatically. They'll be fitted into different density. That's not the same EM density. But I want to do this at the same time, because I know what these symmetry elements are, so if I fit this here, the others have to be done at the same time. I have to generate more than the basic asymmetric unit, this one, this one, this one, and this one. I have to generate more than that because I want to get the environment. I want to make sure that when I fit it, none of the molecules crash into symmetry-related molecules. So I've got to generate quite a few molecules, as you can see here. So if I start with this, I want to generate all the ones in this environment. I want to generate all the molecules in this environment. I want to make sure that each of the four, T equals four, related, symmetry-related, quasi-symmetry-related molecules don't clash, and also that they all fit well. So now a little bit of simple mathematics. How do I do this? I have the structure, crystallographic structure, in some coordinate system of the E1 molecule. That was determined by Felix Rey, as I said. So let me call that an atom in this molecule in its own crystallographic reference frame. Call it at each atom is XYZ or X as a vector notation. Let E be the, E stands for Eulerian, E be the matrix, 3x3 matrix, which moves the atoms in the crystallographic molecule into the first position of the within the EM map. Let's go back. So let E go from the crystallographic coordinates and generate this particular molecule. Now, it doesn't have to be there in the first place, but that's where it ends up eventually. That's the best fit. So that's what E does. E matrix, a rotation matrix. So X prime is the position of the molecule in the first position. But this is only a rotational symmetry. When you rotate something, you also have to place it. It doesn't matter what axis I rotate it about. It can be anywhere. It can be in San Diego. It can be in Purdue. The result of the rotation is the same. But we have to place it. So we can calculate, for instance, the center of gravity or center of mass of the crystallographic coordinates. That gives us an origin of the asymmetric object, the E1 molecule, in its in the crystallographic position, and we'll call that E. That goes with S. So let S be the center of mass in the crystallographic framework, and let us say we think we ought to put it at the point S prime in the EM map. So S is then rotated to S prime, and there has to be a translation vector. What is this translation vector? We'll just change the sublittle formula. So S prime D is given by this expression, therefore, and I can now substitute this in this formula. So X prime can be obtained if I know all the atoms in my crystallographic molecule, I know the center of mass, I can calculate that from all the atoms, and I know S prime is some position roughly appropriate to what I can see in the map. So now I can generate all the atoms in molecule one on what you saw on the previous map. And then I have to multiply by all the all these other 60 or so other elements, 60 times 4 elements actually, which place all the other molecules. And again, I can do this RMT. The subscript M refers to the what I call the crystallographic symmetry, that's to say the icosahedral symmetry, which is perfect, and T refers to this T number symmetry, which is the four possible relationships, and 4 times 60 is 240. I'll get 240 different positions in the end. So X prime goes to X double prime, which are, takes the first molecule into the 240 or 239 other positions in the cell, and that's some algebra on how to do that. So now I've generated all my symmetry positions. Hopefully, none of the molecules are overlapping. But at this point, actually, I only know the crystallographic coordinates, and I know a rough position where this molecule goes. All the others will then be generated. But I don't know the orientation. I know nothing about this, although maybe I can look at it in the map and get some idea. But I want to do this automatically. I want to be able, you know, in the past, people have said, oh, this looks like that. Let's fit it in here. But then these conservative crystallographers will say, oh, well, that's what you think. But I, you know, how do I know that's right? You know, I want to get a fit which I can see how good it is. And that's what all this is about. You know, what are there other fits? How good are the other fits? Am I quite sure that the fit which I've got is the best? All right, so much for symmetry. So now we have to go on to what I just said. Is the fit the best? And as I mentioned before, there are a number of different criteria which we can use. I went over those before. And we now want to make quantitative measurements of this. And there are many different measurements. There are many different programs which do this. For instance, Willy Riggers, when he was here in San Diego, developed a very different kind of fit, which related to the surface of molecules. Now, what we've been doing is not only surface things, but look at the total electron density or EM density of a molecule. How does it fit every point in the EM density? And we have actually found experimentally, for instance, when we were working on dengue virus, and I'll be mentioning something about dengue virus, where we had a 26 angstrom map, that was very good in using the kind of methods which are, or criteria, which I'll describe in a few seconds, which is this first criterion, whereas looking at the shape doesn't work at 26 angstrom, because at 26 angstrom everything flows together, but you've got to look more at the variation of density. We can take all the atoms and ask where, what is the height of the density at that atom, and then take the average density of all the atoms in the molecule. And that's what this is about. This, as you saw, the atoms go to X double prime, and that's the density at X double prime, summed over all the atoms which you fit in your molecule, and you take the average of that, and you see this sum is over. Well, you actually only need to fit, in this case, the four different T-related molecules. The others are exactly the same, because the EM map has icosahedral symmetry, there's no point in fitting the map into 60 different places, fitting the molecule in 60 different places. They're all going to be the same. But there is a point of taking each of the four molecules there, and so you can sum it over the four T equals four related molecules, and this is over all the atoms, and then you take the, you know, normalize it by the number of atoms which you fitted. So you get this measurement, which we call sum F, which is just an average fit of all the atoms to the density in this particular position, which you try. A very important criterion is it's very obvious when you look at something by eye. So people say, oh yeah, I can see it fits. But look, there's a loop out here. It doesn't fit anywhere. So you want to sort of put a very big penalty for putting atoms into regions which really doesn't fit. So you can put it into, say, all atoms which go into negative density, or all atoms which go into density less than a certain arbitrary decided number. And so we can count the number of atoms, express it as a percentage. count the number of atoms which go very bad, go into negative density. You don't want that. And then you want the, well, we don't often use, oh yeah, sorry, this is clash. You also want to count atoms which are too close to an atom in another molecule. So we have to think a little bit about this. We have to get each of the four different molecules which are related by quasi-symmetry and ask what atoms surround them. They're non-crystallographic and crystallographic related molecules. Each one of those atoms has to be counted, and so we sum this over the four different quasi-related molecules, and we count the number of atoms which come too close to an atom in any of the other molecules which I'm not actually fitting at this time, but are related by symmetry. So this avoids steric clashes. That's another criterion, obviously a very important criterion. And finally, what I've mentioned before, we can restrain the whole fitting procedure by other information. And let's look at this other information. So for instance, we can minimize the distance between recognizable features in the cryo-EM map. And a typical example is this, which we use quite extensively. For various reasons, we have been able to find the position of carbohydrate sites. For instance, in the case of Symbisvars, we were able to deglycosylate the glycoproteins, one glycosylation site at a time. So for instance, if we glycosylate at position 318, there was an asparagine which was N-glycosylated. We deglycosylated it, grew the vars, the mutant vars, did a cryo-EM reconstruction, did a difference map, and that gave us a position of 318. Furthermore, it was interesting to see that the position of the carbohydrate at 318 was related to, you know, there are four molecules in the asymmetric unit. Each molecule was deglycosylated now, and these four different sites had to be related by the same symmetry element as we had already established for the T equals 4 symmetry, quasi-symmetry. And we could do this in the case of E1, which I was showed you fitting. There were actually two different glycosylation sites. The other one was something like 254. And we could therefore say we know when we fit the molecule, this is, say, asparagine 318. This has to be close to the carbohydrate sites, which I know is where it should end up. It's a sort of a target site and the site on the fitting on the crystallographic structure where we know this was should be glycosylated. And so the distance between the amino acid on the molecule and the target site in the map should be fairly small, or should be a certain distance. It usually came out to be about 20 angstrom because there's a side chain involved. So you try to make all these sites fairly small because that's how it has to fit. Another possibility, for instance, is if you know a certain contact region to other parts of the structure, like in the case of the polyovars, which I mentioned, we are fitting the structure of the receptor molecule, but we knew that certain part of the receptor molecule, it's a long molecule, and the amino end of the molecule should fit into the canyon of the polyovars, because that's the general hypothesis, this end of the receptor fits into the canyon. And we could see that the molecule fitted into the canyon. We could see that, and we know that the polyovars receptor is a long molecule. So we could say the end, the amino end of the polyovars receptor molecule, which we're fitting into the triune density, should be go to a certain point at the bottom of the canyon. Or near it, not necessarily at it, but near it. So that's another restraint. And then if we fit, for instance, in the case of the polyovars, it has three different domains, immunoglobulin domains, and the structure is a bit uncertain between different domains. So maybe we want to fit each domain separately. We've done that many times, that kind of thing, not only in the polyovars. And then if you fit the first domain, then the second domain, the carboxy end of the first domain, should be near the amino end of the next domain. And so we put a restraint on the distance between the carboxy end of one domain and the amino end of the other domain. So these are all kind of chemical, or whatever you want to call it, information which we know about, which we can put help the fitting. Now, the higher the resolution, the less you need this. But the same is true in crystallography. When crystallographers refine a structure, they put restraints on, like bond lengths, bond angles, and so on. These are exactly the same sort of thing, because most crystallographic maps until recently have been, say, stopped at 2.8 angstrom resolution, where you can't resolve atoms. But when the resolution goes higher, say to 1 angstrom, crystallographers don't need those restraints because the individual atoms are resolved. Same here. So restraints are useful if your resolution is poor. And sometimes it gets better, of course. And so here is then the result of the restraint. You've already seen this, how it fitted. But here, this is, I think, 245. This is a black dot. Circle is 318. These are actually the difference maps which showed the carbohydrate side. So this is the amino acid. This is a C-alpha backbone. This is the amino acid, which is the 318. That's where it has to go. This is difference map, that's where it has to go, and that's 245. So you put those things close together, and so it fits. But this is true not only for this molecule, it's true for this molecule, and that molecule. They all have those two glycosylation sites. All right, let's be continuing then with the story. Now we have these various criteria for fitting. And we have to now combine them. And the way we combine them, we can find the standard deviation of each kind of fit. I'll show you presently how we get those standard deviations. We basically do a random series of fits, and that'll come into the search process. And we can see how these different criteria vary with random fits. Now, it gives us a kind of standard deviation. And we can ask for a particular case, how many standard deviations is this fit better than the average? And we can do that for each of the different types of criteria. So now we have a number, namely the actual fit for that criterion divided by the standard deviations. How many standard deviations are you better than the average? And we can do that for each of the different types of criteria which we like to use. And so the total overall criterion then is here, that's the average value of standard deviation of the criterion, that's its actual value. We take the difference and we divide it by the standard deviation. This can be negative or positive, can be below the average, can be above the average. And W or omega is a weight. You maybe feel that the fit of the structure into density is more important than, how many atoms go into negative density. And so you can put, say, a weight of 1 onto fitting the all the atoms into the density, a weight of, say, 0.5 of the criterion which determines how many atoms are in negative density. So we have a dimensionless number there of the same kind of concept. We can therefore now combine these criteria with this sum. On S tells you what we want to do. See, in the case of putting atoms into density, we want to maximize that. But in the case of putting atoms into negative density, we want to minimize that. So some criteria go for a maximum, others go for a minimum. And so S just is a plus 1 or minus 1 according to what that particular criterion does. And we really want to go in the same direction in all cases. So then we can add them up, we get an overall criterion. Here's an example. I think this example is from the same situation which I, of Synvis was. I'll come to that later. When we, eventually we're going to search. I'll tell you about searching different orientations, different positions, and we'll get different fits. Some are wrong, some are not so wrong. And we do this in a systematic way. We try all orientations, try essentially all positions, and then we get a whole slew of fits. Some are very poor and some are very good, and we refine those. But as we refine them, many of the results come to the same answer, because after all, there is only one answer. If you're at the bottom of a mountain, you walk upwards, there's only one top, but you can start from many places. But maybe there are little tiny hills around there, and other things will come to other mountains. And this is where the question comes in: how good is your fit? My old crystallographic friends would always say, well, it's only cryo-EM, you can't do much with that, you're going to have many answers. Well, this is to show how good is my best answer. And the quality of fit then is how much better is my best answer to the next answer, and give you some idea how unique the result is. And I think this is a very important question. So here we have some F, how well do the atoms fit in the density, how much do they clash, what percentage of atoms go into negative density, what's the average distance from restraints, all different criteria. Then down here, these are normalized with the standard deviation. So let's go down to the bottom table. Same numbers, just divided by the standard deviations. And these are the actual fits. So I took about the top 100 best fits. I sorted them, took the top 100. Of those, many of them converged to the same fit. And there are only four fits were left after taking the top 100. There were only four left. These were the starting points, fit number 13 in the list of 100, fit number 10 in the list of 100. So number 10 was obviously better than 13 before the refinement and before asking how the different criteria work together. So R crit is then the overall fit, and you can see R crit 0.98 is somewhat better than 0.81. It's a difference of about 0.2. But then the next fit is really much less, and this is even negative, because I said if you divide that difference which I had between the actual value minus the standard deviation, can be negative or positive. So you can see these are my only fits which I got, and this one is definitely far better. And why is it better? Because, let's have a look. Well, some F was obviously much better than the next one down. It's almost not quite twice as good as the next one down. The clash, it didn't clash nearly as much as the next one down. This one down here clashed terribly. The amount of atoms in negative density was somewhat bigger here. This one didn't fit quite as well. Divided by the standard deviation, this is actually better in this respect. Average distance is also, well, we've got to think about the signs here, is also the best. So this was definitely the best, giving us this result. These different criteria then come together. What's happened to this pointer? Okay. No, it keeps on. The pointer has got stuck, but never mind. So now we ask the next thing. What about the search process? Well, the search can be a problem because of computing time. And the way, there are better ways of doing it than what I did. And particularly, for Willy Rigger said, I think a better way. But I systematically rotated the molecule and placed it in the position indicated by the estimated position where the center of mass goes, did all the fitting procedure, and then sorted them. And for each of the positions which I found, so the initial rotational search for speed was fairly coarse. I just wanted to get roughly some ideas. And then each result of the, say, the top 100 fits was then refined by a method which I call CLIMB. It could be refined by least squares. I think that would be better. CLIMB is a sort of, well, what you do is you got, say, 6 parameters. You take the first parameter. You keep on increasing or decreasing, as the case may be, until you got to the top of the hill and start coming down again. Then, having got to the top of the hill in the first parameter, you take the next parameter and increase or decrease it until you get to the top of the hill. That's to say, until your criterion is best. And you do this successively for each of the parameters. I'm afraid this battery in here might last eventually. But the pointer is okay, it just doesn't go off. Oh, now it's off. Oh, it's okay now. So the idea of CLIMB, well, first of all, this is the search, putting the initial crystallographic structure into the first position of the molecule. Molecule number one, say, is a Eulerian search. And the way Eulerian angles work is the asymmetric unit can be three angles, of course, three angles to make a rigid body orientation any direction. This goes all the way 360 degrees, this goes 360 degrees, and this only has to go to 180 degrees. If you do more than that, you're really repeating yourself. That's a function of the Eulerian angles. So in that, you maybe do 15 degree increments, and then you can rank according to the sum F value, the fit of the atoms. At this point, you can, having got all these fits, you can find the standard deviation, which you need, as I told you, to combine the different fit results, different criteria. Then you can do the climbing, and this has to be done in fine intervals. I usually do it semi-fine intervals and reduce the fineness until there's no further difference. And finally, can eliminate fits which have arrived at the same or nearly the same result. That's so that leaves only very few fits, because most of the results start at the bottom of the same mountain and come to the top of the same mountain. Now, if you have, say, domains, say three domains or something like this, you might want to fit one domain at a time. The way we have done this quite successfully, fit one domain, and then you can take that domain away from the cryo-EM density. And the way we do that is to put a sphere around each atom, and any grid point of the map which is within that sphere, we can call it zero. That's, we just zero out essentially all the density associated with the first fit. And so that when we fit the next domain, any part of the next domain which happens to go into the part which you zeroed out will be like negative density. That's a bad thing. And so on. Then we fit the next domain, zero it out, fit the next domain, and so forth. Now I'll be showing you some results there, and we can ask, if I fit not from domain 1, 2, 3, and 4, if I start with 4, go to 3, go to 2, to 1, does the order of fitting matter? And of course it shouldn't matter, and it doesn't matter if you do it right. But that is another process of validation. And this is just shows you something about the climbing procedure. Here we've already climbed to the top of the mountain. These are arbitrary values of R crit, the fitting parameter. And so here we have 6 parameters, 3 angles, and 3 positions. We go in these in degrees, and we have, say, quarter of a degree. We take a quarter of a degree from the best value is shown here, take a quarter of a degree off, and we see the R crit is the fitting parameter is now less than this. In one direction we add, and that's also less. So we're at the top of the mountain. We're top of the mountain for each of the 6 parameters. So this is the final result of a climb search. Now I'll show you the result of doing some fitting in the case of dengue virus. In the case of dengue virus, mature dengue virus, the structure of a homologous molecule had been determined for tick-borne encephalitis virus, which is this, and this was done again by Felix Ray when he was in Steve Harrison's lab. Since this is dengue virus, the structure for dengue virus has been determined both by Yogi Modis in Steve Harrison's lab and by Yang Zhang in my lab at Purdue. And so this is the structure which we have to fit. In fact, at the time, we didn't really know whether it would be a dimer like this or a monomer, although there are indications it should be a dimer as this is. So we have the cryo-EM density. Now, this is actually not the cryo-EM density which I fitted in the first place. I think this is now at 16 angstrom. This was at about 16 angstrom resolution. The original map was at 26 angstrom resolution. But it shows you the result. It shows it much better in this case because it's a higher resolution. So fitting the first dimer, we put the first dimer onto the crystallographic twofold axis, which is somewhere in the middle here. This is the crystallographic asymmetric unit, the same one as I showed you before in the icosahedron. There's a twofold axis here. You can see that. That goes to that. That goes to that. That goes to that, and so on. So we put the first one here. So all we had to do is to rotate this thing around here and moving up and down the radial axis of the molecule. And here is the fit. As you can see, it fits pretty well. At this point, I didn't know how much electron density was left. And I'll show you later, or presently, a measure of how much density was left. I found there was space for one more dimer, or two more monomers. And you can actually see that here. That's where it goes. And you'll see how well this fits. There we go. So that's the fit. And then if you put this now... multiply by the icosahedral or crystallographic symmetry, if you this threefold, that fivefold, it makes the whole virus. There we go. And this actually shows the domains, the three domains in each monomer, the yellow domain, the red domain, and the blue domain. Actually, the red domain is domain one, that yellow is two, and three, blue is three. That's along the polypeptide chain. And you can see it fits very well. I always like to show this. I always complain. We had our paper rejected by Nature because the referees didn't think we'd done the fitting right. And see, this is actually, it is a rather questionable fitting in some ways because it doesn't obey, it should be T equals 3. Three monomers in the asymmetric unit. Therefore, there's a certain symmetry associated with T equals 3 symmetry, which this doesn't have. So that was one of the problems about a fitting. But you can see it fits very well. And anyway, it was rejected by Nature, but it was accepted later after much backwards and forwards argument by Cell. But anyway, it's obviously right. So now that fitting also introduces me to the question of membranes. Here, this is again dengue virus at a somewhat lower resolution than we have it now. The fitted structure is shown in sort of outline here in the blue density, and there's a core, and in between is a lipid bilayer. You can see the beautiful bilayer, and these are the transmembrane proteins. All this structure has now been fitted by, particular by Wei Zhang at Purdue, and that's published. This is probably a very good example of where you can actually see in a cryo-EM structure the real transmembrane proteins like you don't normally see crystallographically, because crystallographers, when they look at membrane proteins, they mix it with detergent and so on. They get some idea where the membranes is, where the lipid is. But this is actually a membrane protein in situ, in the virus, which you don't see very often. By fitting the outer density, we could now see, recognize where the membrane is. Okay, continuing then, and this is where the fun part comes in, the validation. And we can have a number of criteria for validation, all kinds of, I mean, there's an infinite number of criteria, really. Are the results independent of the order of fitting of compounds? I've mentioned that. I'll show you an example where we've done this. When you have a cryo-EM map, unless you do special tilting experiments, you generally don't know what the absolute hand of that map is. Now, when you fit your X-ray structure, you know what the X-ray structure is. I won't go into all that, but for instance, you know helices are right-handed, so you always make sure you got right-handed helices. There's also an absolute way of getting it crystallographically using anomalous dispersion. But anyway, X-ray maps come with an absolute hand. So we can fit the structure with, take the cryo-EM map and fit the X-ray structure, and then invert the cryo-EM map and fit the X-ray structure again. Which one fits better? Now, if in some cases you've got more than one protein, I'll be showing you a case like that, all the proteins should produce the same hand for the map, and that's a good way of validating that you fitted the things right, in the right place. And are the distance between atoms in the interface reasonable? When you fit different proteins into the map, do they have correct kind of distances? Do they have the correct kind of amino acids? Are hydrophobic residues? Are contacts made by hydrophobic residues? Hydrophobic residues? Are there polar complementarity and charged complementarity, and so on? And then another question which you have to ask is, have I interpreted all parts of the map? Are all the higher parts of the electron density, of the EM map, have they all been interpreted? Are some parts left out? And what are these parts? What about unexpected results in terms of, do they make chemical sense? And I'll give you examples of most of these now as we go along. This is a case, this is a fit of, it's again is dengue virus, but it's an immature structure, and the dengue virus has, like many viruses, has a maturation process where usually some protease, some cellular protease, cleaves some viral protein, and that often produces large conformational changes which matures the virus. Until the virus has matured, the virus is not infectious. And this is some way viruses have a way of being able to assemble in peace, and only at the final end is some tremendous important event happens, the maturation event, which makes the virus infectious, and now the virus can go on its warpath. So this is the structure, or part of the structure, of immature dengue virus. And down here again, you have the lipid membrane, because it's a whole virus. We just see a little part, and this is just part of the fitted structure. There again, it's three E proteins, and this time they don't make dimers, they make monomers, and we fitted these, actually Ying Zhang did this, into the cryodensity. Notice there's a lot of unfitted density. Well, that actually pleased us, because in the immature dengue virus, there are two surface proteins. There's the E protein, which is a glycoprotein, E for envelope protein. There's also a PRM, a pre-M membrane protein. And it's the PRM protein which gets cleaved, and the small prepeptide of about 100 amino acids comes off the virus during the maturation process. And so this structure here, which has this sort of spike, then changes conformation to produce the structure I showed you on the one of the previous slides with all the nice colors and the T equals 3 symmetry or non-symmetry. So this pleased us, because now the prepeptide is presumably, this is where the prepeptide is, and this then comes off, exposes all this rest, and the whole thing falls down and makes these dimer arrangements. That we published that, but on the other hand, I always felt this was a very unlikely structure, and I was never happy. I still am not happy. But I will show you some other results presently. I know my time is getting up, which really completely validate what this structure is. First of all, that result which I just showed you, you see there were three different E proteins which had to be fitted, and they had overlapping density. And would the result be the same, independent of whether the structure, which E monomer was fitted first? Every time I fit an E monomer, then That density is zeroed out, and the next one is fitted. And that density is zeroed out, leaving only density for the last one. And then the last one, of course, hasn't got much chance of being fitted wrongly if the first two densities were subtracted correctly. And this is the first fit, second fit, third fit. This is at position A. So, for instance, if I fit the first molecule A, then at B I could have the second fit, at C I could have the third fit, and so on. And what this is shows you here is the sum F. That's the quality of the fit of the each of the atoms in the molecule. And this is domain 1, domain 2, domain 3. They all should fit about the same value. These are normalized, so the highest density would be 100, and this is the average fit of the atoms to this density. So an independent of whether first, second, or third, I have roughly the same kind of distribution of fit of each domain in each of the for each of the three different positions where the molecule can be fitted, and the x, y, z, and the theta one. That's to say, the translational position and the orientation position are essentially the same. So in this case, at least the sequence of fitting gave you the same, essentially the same result. So now I want to come to the hand problem, which I've mentioned. I want to mention in this respect our work on T4, phage T4, bacterial virus. It has a head, it has a tail, it has a base plate. I want to concentrate on the base plate. The base plate is kind of the nerve center of the whole thing. When the virus recognizes an E. coli cell with the ends of these long tail fibers, then the base plate undergoes a major conformational change. This is called the hexagonal base plate. It becomes a star-shaped base plate. I just want to talk about the hexagonal base plate, which is the base plate of the mature virus, which is ready to infect. It has a large number of proteins in it, many of them in multiple copies. We did a cryo-EM reconstruction of the base plate with the tail tube, and here is a representation of the cryo-EM density. And we also determined some, at least, quite a few of the proteins in this by X-ray structure determination. Here they are. This is missing one. We've now determined GP10. GP means gene product, not glycoprotein, gene product 11, 8, and so on. And so all these things had to be fitted into the cryo-EM density, which I showed you on the previous slide. The way they fit very uniquely, actually, using both CALLS, which is the Willy Riggers program, and EMFIT, which is the program I was describing, which I wrote, the different colors are the different proteins, and the different colors are also described here in terms of their GP number. So they fit, and you can see GP5 actually is that cell puncturing device. Now, each of these should give you the same hand or the map. And there we go. Here are four of these proteins, GP8, 11, 10, and 12. And the correct hand fitting these X-ray structures into the cryo-EM map with what we now think is the correct hand gives us the correlation coefficient between the X-ray structure and the cryo-EM map of these values. But if you invert the map, then and try to find the best fit for the inverted map, then the correlation coefficients are these, and you can see in each case the best fit is the same, and the hand is determined in the same way for each of these proteins. Now you see that for GP12, which actually are the short tail fibers, these are long fibers under which are at the base of the base plate down here, the purple ones. Down here, these are the short tail fibers. See, these are really sort of circularly averaged, so they have a little bit of structure at this end. And so, if you're circularly averaged, it doesn't give you much information about the hand. So that's why GP12 doesn't give you much of a differentiation. But nevertheless, it does give a differentiation, and the way it does it is consistent with the other things. So this is a nice way of confirming that not only have you fitted these structures in the same place, in the correct place, but they also give you always the same hand of the map. Now, what about finding the interactions between molecules? Going back to SynBisVars, here's the membrane. As I mentioned, there are two glycoproteins, E1, which is the protein I talked about, which was fitted with those glycosylation sites. We can then, zero out the map, and what should remain is the structure of E2. Unfortunately, we at this time do not have the structure of E2. But this is the cryo-EM density then, which remains after subtracting this molecule. And we can now ask questions about which residues on E1 are closest to this the density of E2 these are just the alpha atoms, but we can put in the side chains. Which side chains actually go into this density? Those are the side chains which would make density, and indeed those side chains are very reasonable side chains to make contact with another molecule. I also mentioned the question of how much density have we fitted all the density, this goes back to dengue virus. And remember, in here, the first thing I did there was fit the dimer on the icosahedral 2-fold axis here, and this column relates to that initial fit. After fitting this, the question was how much density is there left? Is there space for another dimer to fit? We could therefore take the ratio of the number of grid points which were fitted as opposed to the number of grid points which were not fitted. And we could sort those grid points in terms of height. So down here at the bottom are the very large, those grid points which had the largest density, and then successively these are the smallest density. Now the largest density are the things which are most important for fitting. If there's a large density, surely something must fit here. And you can see in the case of large densities, the ratio of the unfitted density to the fitted one was a factor of 2. This showed me that if I had fitted one monomer, there's space for another 2 monomers. So then, as you may remember, I showed you, I fitted the next dimer, another 2 monomers, and I can ask the same question, and that's shown in ratio 2. So after I fitted the next monomer, there were actually no large, no grid points with very large density left at all. They were all fitted. Only when the densities got smaller were there some unfitted density. And you want some unfitted density, that's where the water goes and so on. So that's a question which has to be answered. Do I have everything fitted? Is it fitted correctly? Now, the next two slides, I must apologize for the next two slides. They're very new results, sort of last week, really. And they're not very good slides, but they try to make a point. There are two slides which sort of go together. They're made by Ying Zhang. So this refers to the immature dengue virus and immature West Nile virus. Dengue virus and West Nile virus are viruses in the same genus. They're basically homologous viruses. They can be kind of superimposed. So Ying did a reconstruction of West Nile virus and immature virus and dengue immature virus. And then she asked, you can ask many questions about this. She asked, on the surface of this virus, which virus has the biggest radius? And where you see blue here is where West Nile virus has the bigger radius. And this is just the surface. You can see the surface diagram. And where you see red, dengue virus has the bigger surface. Now, in West Nile virus, there are two glycosylation sites. At 154 in E and 15 in PIM. In dengue virus, there are 3 glycosylation sites, at 153 and 67 in E and 69 PIM. You notice the two viruses are not glycosylated at the same sites. So where, for instance, West Nile virus is glycosylated, which is in blue, there should be a blue outer surface, because the carbohydrate makes the surface go further out. And so where there's blue, there should be glycosylation sites in West Nile virus and vice versa for dengue virus. Notice, however, that 154 and 153 are two residues next door to each other, and they probably cancel out. So what we might expect to see then is in red, glycosylation sites at 67, 69, and in blue, 15. And we see this in the three different molecules. You see this in the three different molecules. So here we see this, and in fact we see at this is 15 in blue, so it's West Nile virus glycosylation sites on PIM, and 67 in red, that's dengue virus, 67, and 69 in that's E PIM in dengue. So you see a group of three here, and a group of three there, a group of three here, which goes to the three different molecules, which you saw here, the three different fitted molecules, which I saw gave you on a previous slide. So now we have verified that indeed the PIM is exactly where we thought it was, because these sites are on that outer unfitted density, and the E is exactly where we think it is, because we know where the sites are. So this verifies the structure of the immature dengue virus, West Nile virus reconstructions. Finally, in terms of verification, this is again a very new result. The receptor for dengue virus is it's an ancillary receptor. It's called DC-sign. It stands for dendritic cell ICAM-1 grabbing molecule or something like that. And DC-sign is a tetramer, and it has each monomer has a carbohydrate recognition domain. The structure of the carbohydrate recognition domain has been determined by X-ray crystallography. Structures here, and furthermore, this carbohydrate recognition domain has been the structure has been solved together with the sugar on it. So we know where the sugar goes, and fitting it. We did a reconstruction of the carbohydrate recognition domain complexed with dengue virus, and the difference density is here in blue, and you can see actually that same structure, which I've been talking about here. That's the central dimer, that's the outside dimer. And so this is where the carbohydrate recognition domain binds. It binds actually over two of the glycosylation sites, which I showed you on the previous slide for dengue. So it looks as though the carbohydrate recognition site goes exactly to two sites which are associated with a longer sugar, which binds, which is crystallographically determined with the tetrasaccharide, which was bound to the carbohydrate recognition site, and that would indicate that each of these carbohydrate sites, one on the red molecule, the other on the purple molecule, goes into parts of the parts where the sugar carbohydrate bound to the CRD, carbohydrate recognition site. Now, it binds across these two. Why does it not bind to any other of these? Because these two sites are only, I think, about 15 angstrom apart. Apparently, it needs these two sites to bind across there. So this carbohydrate moiety at this site here, which is asparagine 153, which is there and there and there, doesn't come. There are no two sites close enough together. So the molecule requires two of these sites together to be able to bind this. The others are too far apart. And this gives the idea then how the whole of the DC sign receptor molecule will bind, which is shown here. That's a tetramer. There's a linker region to a core, and then there are two other things up here. This also asks, what does this receptor do? Well, it actually helps to cluster the molecules, and it also then leaves space, interestingly enough, for the actual receptor. Nobody knows what that is, but up here there will be space for there has to be space for the major receptor. This is only an ancillary receptor. There has to be space for the major receptor. And that's available here. Now, normally, if it was probably T equals 3, that wouldn't be there. It would be equally distributed. So the unusual symmetry of this, non-T equals 3 symmetry, actually gives this virus an advantage in being able to use the ancillary receptor in this way. So one more little thing then. The last item, other problems, symmetry mismatch, unknown structural segmentation is this nice word which I learned. And here is, in fact, the cryo-EM reconstruction of the head of T4. And you notice the symmetry mismatch here. If we average with five-fold symmetry about the head that has five-fold symmetry, the tail actually has six-fold symmetry. And you can see the tail is all washed out, while the rest has good structure. Now, we can do the opposites, average with six-fold symmetry, then the head is a mess, and the tail makes sense. And that helps us to find the very convoluted interface between the tail and the head. And then there are various proteins on the head. We have the structure of the purple one here, which we fitted. The blue one is homologous, so we can fit that also. That's GP24 at the vertices and GP23 here. The yellow is something called HOC, or the highly antigenic outer capsid protein, and the white is SOC, or a small outer capsid protein. And so we were able to find where these proteins were because we were able to look at mutants. One mutant was HOCless, was without SOC, HOC minus, and so we could see exactly where the yellow proteins are, and the SOC, we had a HOC minus, SOC minus mutant, and we could see where both of them were by subtraction. So this is experimental way of learning how to fit where the different proteins are. And now finally, I just want to acknowledge the many, many people who've participated in this in T4, Peter Lyman, Viktor Kostyuchenko, they did a lot of the crystallographic work and fitting, Paul Chipman is our great electron microscopist, Shuji Kanemaru did some of the mutational work and also X-ray crystallography, Mark Van Raj is not actually part of our work, but he worked in Leiden until he went to Spain, and he did the structure of short tail fibers. Andrei Fokin did the head work. Fumi Arisaka was Shuji's boss in Tokyo, and Rao helped us with the head, and Vadim Meshianchinov produced a lot of wonderful students like Peter and Victor, who came to Purdue, and TJ Antoni Battisti worked with Paul Chipman in the EM work. Dengue virus, Wei Zhang, Ying Zhang, I've mentioned, and Sushitana Mukhopadhyay, I always find that name very difficult, they all worked, and Elena Pokdiasheva did the work on the DC sign work together with Ying Zhang, and Glenn Gregorio and Wayne Henriksen produced the clones for which this was produced, and Richard Kuhn is the instigator of all this. I've mentioned TJ and Paul Chipman already. Tim Baker was involved in this. And Simbis virus, again, the same cast of characters, including Sergei Strelkov, who did some of the mutation works of deglycosylation. Poliovirus, Yongning He, did much of that. Stefan Müller has produced the polyvirus receptor molecule for crystallography, not quite finished yet. Valerie Bowman is an EM person. Eckhard Wimmer, with whom we collaborate on this, and Richard Kuhn. And the program development was done by Ricardo Bernal, River Chuan Chio, and myself. And that's it. Thank you.
Wonderful tour of all of this. This is great. Are there questions?
I'm afraid it's a bit over time.
When you're fitting the structures, it seems to me that your weighting of clashing and going into negative density was the same. Is that true?
Weighting and clashing going negative density. It's the same, do you say?
Yeah.
Well, they all are bad things to do. I agree with...
It seems to me that going into negative density it's okay because your map might just be,
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to clash, but it shouldn't go into negative density. Yeah, bad thing. I mean, that is in a sense the same as fitting all the atoms, but all I'm saying is it's okay to fit something into density. It's not so good to fit something in low density. It's really bad when something sticks out of density. You know, this is something which you, when you see it visually on a screen and something sticks out of density, you literally immediately go into shock. And I wanted to put that into the program, this concept of, this is really bad, don't do this.
But to me, clashing is much worse than going into negative.
Well, as I showed you, I had weights. If you think that, you can put a bigger weight on that and get a slightly different result. If you change the weights a little bit, it doesn't make much difference. But if you do a lot, it can make some difference. You obviously want to keep some reality. So the reality is the EM density. You want to keep a good weight on that. Or else if you say you put zero weight on that, you've got no information really. You're just doing things on how things don't clash, and there could be many ways in which things don't clash. Again, crystallography has the same problem. Whenever in a normal crystallography refinement, you got two things. You got the fit to the X-ray data, and you got the what's called the energy term, all the bond lengths and so on. You can neglect all the X-ray data, and then you have purely an energy refinement process. So do we check them, do you say?
Yeah, so you compare the dengue virus and the best of Nile virus. Actually, I said that you see the blue density and the red state. So how can you be sure that the pixel size is corrected? And also, how can you be sure the contour level of the map is consistent so you can compare the size?
Well, yeah, Ying did some scaling of the maps, like I showed you at the beginning. So the maps had the same kind of resolution and the same kind of fall-off before she did the differences. Actually, as I said, this was a very new result. I need to discuss with her. Really she's doing a difference map by just showing the surfaces. She's looking at the surfaces, which is where the carbohydrates are, by doing this kind of representation. But a difference map should really show the same thing, but maybe should draw the surface over the difference map. I don't know. I didn't really like those slides. I asked Ying to produce some quick slides about 3 days ago when she got the results, so I could show them here, because I think it's a nice result. There are lots of things we still got to look at there, and it's not a terrible. I think the it's about 20 angstrom resolution.
Could you say a little bit, Michael, about how you prepare the coordinates for doing these fitting? I mean, for instance, if there's a sequence difference, do you do something? Do you trim away some of the side chains, or?
Oh, if there's a sequence difference between what and what? Well, I don't have the right structure, sometimes like when we fitted the TBEV structure into a dengue map. Well, actually, we did two things there. I did two things. I fitted just the C alpha atoms, and I fitted the C alpha atoms decorated arbitrarily with the dengue sequence. We know the sequence. And it gave basically the same result. Didn't make much difference at 26 angstrom when we first did it. At a higher resolution, they might do it. Actually, I have some ideas about when I saw Steve Lutke give those maps, very beautiful maps of the ion channel and Goyal, seeing those alpha helices. I just wondered whether we could do some difference work here by making an alpha helix and subtracting it from the map and seeing maybe what maybe, I know Steve has any comments on that, find the orientation of the alpha helix, because we know where the side chains are. We don't know what the side chains are. We know how they relate on the alpha helix. Is there any relationship of that to these, relatively speaking, for this kind of work, a low resolution What can one do in this way by fitting?
So CL, the coordinates are generally good enough for very low resolution then? Is that what you find?
Well, some of our work is much higher resolution, but say a 20 angstrom resolution, C alphas will probably do okay. There's also the question of domain fitting. For instance, in the immature vars, immature dengue vars, there's quite a lot of domain angle fitting. We fitted each of the domains separately, both in the immature and the mature vars. So we increase the number of parameters there. So you have to think about that. And as you increase the number of parameters of fit, you've got to obviously go to higher resolution. The lower the resolution, the fewer parameters you should use. Same as crystallography. Say, is there a conformational change?
Well, how does it program?
Well, as I said, you fit one domain, subtract it, fit the next domain, subtract it, fit the next domain, so on. You then have to ask, of course, is this how much better is your fit than if you kept it as a single rigid body? And then we can compare things like R-crit, and we can compare the overall result. Never quite sure, but in fact the domains move a lot. In the case of these flavivars like dengue vars and West Nile vars, it goes from immature to mature, and then there are crystallographic structures of the post fusion structure where there are incredible large changes. The whole thing becomes a trimer, and the domains change the angle. So it's as much as, I think, 30 degrees between the immature domain 1 to domain 2 to domain 1. The angle between domain 2 and domain 1 changes by as much as 30 degrees between the immature structure and the post fusion structure, with the mature structure being in between. So there's quite a lot of difference. You should be able to see that.
Well, thank you.